All right. We're talking to David Little from the Rural Schools Association. David, you want to tell us what the Rural Schools Association is?
Sure. The Rural Schools Association of New York State is a not-for-profit association of about 315 public school districts throughout New York State that obviously focuses on the rural character of the school district. We also are in partnership with Cornell University, and I run the rural schools program there, which operates the Center for Rural Schools, which is a data center, and we provide services to those school districts for planning purposes, for demographic studies, for student performance studies, and we also obviously advocate on their behalf.
And we've brought you here today to give us a little information about, I guess, the school budget hearings and school elections that are, the budget hearings start this week and the elections are May 17th. What is different about this year's school budgets that are being put together?
Well, the dramatic difference this year is twofold. One, we've legislatively created a funding crisis for our public school districts this year because New York State decided to one-up every other state in imposing its form of a tax cap. In virtually every other state that has a tax cap, you have either a 2.5% tax rate that's a cap, or you have the cap on the total spending of a municipality that includes the school district, so there's some flexibility in funding. New York State went a step further and said, we're not only going to have the lowest tax cap at 2%, but we're going to make it 2% or the rate of consumer inflation, whichever is lower. And the fact that this year consumer inflation is at zero has made the local property tax cap a local property tax freeze for school districts. And to make up for the fact that local school districts can't raise any additional revenue on their own, and in some cases actually have less money to spend under the tax cap than they had last year, the state needed to provide significantly more state aid than it did in this year's state budget. What they've done is left a number of school districts in a deficit situation or with the inability to meet their normal costs from year to year. What I would say about our consumer inflation link to the tax cap is that the things that consumers buy and what determines the consumer rate of inflation has absolutely nothing to do with the goods and services that a school district spends its money on. And so linking the two has created this unnatural situation that has left school districts needing by law to pay for things like contractual obligations to its instructional and non-instructional staff. But school districts spend money on things like running diesel fuel in their buses for, you know, perhaps 10 hours a day. Consumers obviously don't pay for that. But most importantly, consumers don't pay for employee health insurance that's in double digits, or for a state retirement system that has an increase that's also in double digits this year. And so when you have those kind of expenses and you're allowed no more money at either the state or the local level, the only thing that is left for you to do is to dismantle the educational programs and services that you provided in the year before. And that's absolutely inappropriate because the state is not hurting for money at present. Its economy is growing. It had the revenue available to be able to pay for a significant increase that would keep school districts from being in this bind, and yet it chose not to do so.
I want to understand both. Why is something economic linked to something educational? Like, are students supposed to get smarter in years the economy is worse or something? Or and what would you advocate in place of the tax cap?
Well, here's the problem in New York State. In virtually every other state in the union, the state pays for two-thirds of the cost of public education, and local property taxpayers pay for one-third of the cost. In New York State, the state pays only 40% of the cost of public education, leaving 60% to the federal government and the vast majority, over 50%, to local taxpayers. That means in communities where local taxpayers have the ability to provide significant resources, you get a great education. And for those communities that cannot afford to provide significant resources, you get the absolute bare state minimum of curriculum. So even though many of our school districts graduate the vast majority of their kids, the education that they've received doesn't make them competitive either in the workplace or in college, because they haven't had the kind of curriculum and programs and services needed for them to be able to put the information they learn into any kind of context. So, you know, your question about whether public education, you know, ebbs and flows, you know, I always say that, you know, you can't fund public education with a chart that looks like an EKG that bounces up and down when public education is actually on an incline. It's sequential. It builds on itself. And if you get a couple of years where you take away programs and services from a child's education, study after study will tell you that that's non-recoverable, that they will never get back in the span of time that they have in their public education to where they should be to be able to be competitive when they leave school.
And does this impact, from what you're saying, it sounds like it impacts rural districts more.
Well, it impacts rural districts more because, A, they have a diminished tax base. The Great Recession left many, many rural communities with both fewer students and fewer businesses there to support them. So you've got very little tax base to try and raise revenue under. We have school districts that, you know, under even a 2% tax cap, don't raise $50,000. Well, when you've got, as I said, 10%, 12% increases in both health care costs for your employees that you can't control, and the state imposes a state retirement system increase of over 10% on you, then you do nothing. You have no ability to do anything but cut teachers, to cut other programs and services from your school district. We know that that schools, rural schools in particular, operate among the most leanly operated enterprises within the state. And Cornell Research will tell you that that rural New York shares more public services among municipalities and school districts than any other place on the planet. So they're doing what they can with the resources that they have, but quite honestly, the state's funding formula simply doesn't recognize how poor a district actually might be. In fact, we have some school districts that are literally twice as poor as our state funding formula will recognize, and so they have no ability to respond when the state both imposes a local property tax cap and a state aid cap on them by not providing them the necessary resources. So we have a situation this year that made it worse than normal, not only by capping those local resources, but when it came time to pass the state budget, because most of the money under the GEA, the gap elimination adjustment, which was a means that the state used when it was hurting for money to take money away from public education, to restore that, the money that needed to be restored that was left in that formula mostly went to wealthy school districts. And so by the time they paid for the wealthy school districts to have their GEA restored so that that wouldn't exist anymore, and the time that the money that they spent to pay all school districts for things that they had already spent money on with a law being in place that the state would repay them for the money that they spent for things like transportation, BOCES aid, building aid, and special educational costs, the state pays a percentage of those each year when school districts have spent money on it the year before. So by the time they spent $400 and some million on the GEA, they spent $400 and some million on these reimbursable items, and they spent a couple $100 million, $175 million for a new community schools concept, you had very little money to distribute under the standard formula that was the only means for most rural schools to get their money.
Voters are headed to, or could be going to, budget hearings at various schools this week and next, and headed to the polls on May 17th. What should they look at, or what can they do with all this, or what are they faced with, I guess?
Well, I think local voters have probably been exposed to enough of this to recognize what's going on. The state hasn't provided local school districts with the resources to be able to maintain what they have, and so some school districts may be presenting a budget that cuts programs from the school. I think that people need to recognize that despite that, that the school has no control over that, and those school budgets need to be supported. I think that many times people have an adverse reaction thinking, I'm going to vote against the budget because I don't want to see this, that, or the other program cut, when in fact they're simply trying to provide the mandated goods and services and educational programs that the state requires. And so by the time they do that, there's simply no money left for anything else. I think that voters are smart enough to recognize that when you have a local property tax freeze, that even if the school district is going above the cap at perhaps 2% or 3%, they're doing it for good cause, because the state has not provided them sufficient resources to be able to run a school that the community would be proud to have its children attend.
So it's almost, voters have no choice to pass the budgets. If they vote against the budget because things have been cut and the budget fails, all that's going to happen is the budget's going to be cut further for the second vote, right?
Probably. There are some districts where if the budget fails, the school district, because it will be limited to the amount of money that it used last year, there are some districts that this bizarre legislative crisis has created this year that's actually the best result that they could hope for, because their tax cap is actually below zero this year. So, but for most school districts, you know, support for the budget is still very important, even though they may be asking for only the amount at the cap, or they may be asking for an amount that might go over the cap, in which case the community will need to rally around the school district and understand that they're only asking for perhaps 2% of a tax increase, which would be normal under any other tax cap in the nation, but for New York State's kind of bizarre additional requirement that it be at the rate of consumer inflation, that a 2% or a 3% increase is absolutely warranted, given the fact that their major costs are increasing at double-digit rates.
And is there any effort in Albany to alter or change this, and who is the lobbying force that's trying to stop it?
There are any number of entities that are lobbying for change to that. Our Rural Schools Association among them, obviously the state's teachers union and the state school boards association, council of school superintendents, business officials, PTA. There's an organization called REFIT that I'm the head of, called, it stands for Reform Educational Funding Inequities Today. And that association has long been involved in that. There are two lawsuits currently pending that we're waiting for decisions on. One is the Campaign for Educational Equity, that is the successor to a successful lawsuit that forced the state to spend more until the state abandoned its responsibilities under that court order when the Great Recession hit. The thing that I tried to point out to people is that public education in New York State is a constitutional right. This isn't an option for the state of New York. The Court of Appeals, the highest court in the state of New York, has determined that a Regents diploma is what constitutes the state's educational requirement to its children. And the state systematically put into place a gap elimination adjustment that took funds unconstitutionally away from public education and away from the amount that was necessary to uphold the state's constitutional responsibility. So the Campaign for Educational Equity has sued under that order to enforce that order, and the Small Cities School Districts Association has also sued, several small cities have sued, saying that the way that we distribute our money is unconstitutional under the state's constitution. And so we're awaiting both of those decisions. And now that the GEA has been eliminated in law, we go about the hard work of trying to come up with a sound and equitable funding formula for public education for the next generation. You know, right now, the state's funding formula does not recognize whether a community can adequately provide for the public education of its children. So when a community can't adequately provide for that, the state obviously has the responsibility under the state constitution to provide the difference between what the community can afford and what's necessary to uphold its constitutional responsibility. It hasn't been doing that, and a new funding formula will be necessary to do that. Some people have said, well, why don't we go back to the funding formula that the Campaign for Fiscal Equity imposed, that the state agreed to, the state stipulated to, and the court ordered. And that would be great, except for it's now over a decade old, and communities have lost property wealth in many communities. Many other communities have lost a number of students in that time because there's been an exodus, largely from rural communities, in New York State, because people can't afford to live there. And so we need to start from scratch with the funding formula to try and figure out the accurate amount to be able to assess what a community can afford and how to provide the kids in that community the difference so that they're competitive, so that all kids, when they get out of school, can compete either in the workplace or in college.
And whatever side you are on these issues, contacting your legislators seems to be the way to affect change in this on these issues. Is that correct?
That's always the most important thing, is to make sure that they hear from more than what they would term the educational establishment. If they hear from me or they hear from the other educational associations, statewide educational associations, they expect that. They expect that we will be relentlessly clamoring for change to the system and more equity. And they account for that. What they don't account for is when the public starts to raise its voice generally about the issue and lets them know that unless individual legislators speak to that issue and help on that issue, that the public needs to get somebody to replace them who will be effective on that issue. I think that the reason, although, you know, it's been incredibly problematic to public education, all of the discord over testing and opting out and all of that, but the one thing it does show us is that the system politically will respond when there's an overwhelming public outcry. And, you know, the outcry over testing should be a whisper compared to the outcry that people should have over the fact that their children are being denied a constitutional right. You know, if the public were told on any given day that their right to freedom of the press or their right to freedom of religion or freedom of assembly was going to be suspended for a decade because the state was a little short of money, there'd be a revolution. But somehow the state of New York feels that it has the ability to suspend the constitutional right to a sound public education of its children for over a decade and simply not uphold it because it said, well, we don't really have the money. It had the obligation to reprioritize its funding to make sure that it upheld its constitutional responsibility. And we need to move forward in a way that works us back toward that goal.
All right, David Little with the Rural Schools Association, thank you for joining us today and getting us up to speed on the school elections coming up May 17th.
You're more than welcome.